is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Grahamian Report, where we bring you dispatches from beyond the fringe every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via the wonders and the marvels of KGRradio.com. Of course, I'm your doctor, your guide here in space-time, and joining me, as always, is the Grahamian Reverend himself, the man with the kind eyes, Mr. Matthew Oakley. How you doing, pal?
Wonderful. And yourself?
Marvelous, indeed. So marvelous. So fine, so dandy. If I were any finer, there would be two of me. So saith the man with two hearts. A lot of heart put into this program by our good friends at Gaia. If you get a moment, be sure and head over to gaia.com/Grahamian. Check them out. Proud sponsors of this program. More on that after a bit. And later in the program, we're also going to be delving into the heart of the green hell. I've had a lot on my mind lately. Travel is often something that encompasses my thought process, but we're going to look at some stories. Matt has some great stories that he has found this week, which have really gotten me thinking about famous explorers, people who have vanished. Some of them have come back. It's actually going to be twofold. We're going to do a brief segment in the first hour and then a feature later in the program. One of the most enigmatic disappearances of an intrepid explorer ever recounted. We don't know what happened to this individual. We have an idea probably what could have happened. But this person was in search of a lost and possibly advanced civilization. Maybe archaeology can help uncover the answer to that mystery. That and news awaits you, all my friends out there in Gradio Land, and of course, back in Master Control, the man collectively known as the Bow, the face of Bow, the Hobbo, that is, Mr. Race Hobbs. How are you doing, my brother?
I'm doing well, Micah. Hello, Gralians. How you doing, Matt?
Oh, pretty good, Hob. Better now that I hear your sweet, dulcet tones.
Yeah.
Oh, I can say the same about you, my friend. I'm jealous that I don't get to see the tree you guys were talking about in pre-show.
Yeah, exactly. We've got a live feed running down here because it gets a little dark and dank down here in the bunker, and so we actually have that monitor right there, and it's not set to news. It's not set to monitoring reverberations that are emanating from deep below ground here. No, we actually have that trained using a webcam system, of course. We have that trained on my apple cherry tree that exists in the field above ground next to the shack, the undisclosed location that is the entry point to the elevator that brings people down into the hollow earth.
A clue to the entrance to the bunker.
I can't say too much. I can only tell you that the road nearest to us, there is a black mailbox on it, and it's called Gray Street.
And there's a real pretty tree out there somewhere.
Oh, you know, this time of the year, almost any time of the year, somewhere out there, there's a spring flower blooming, and that one spring flower is always a little prettier than the rest, isn't she?
Oh.
Yeah, indeed. Spring is the time for love, after all, but love comes in many forms, Race, and I just want you to know, you too, Matt, I love both of you guys, despite the fact that you have that deep, bassy voice that both of you get compliments on all the time.
Come on, you're the mouth of the South. What are you talking about?
Artist formerly known as Mouth of the South, currently operating as the Doctor of Space-Time. Thank you.
You're the doctor.
I'm somebody's doctor.
I just love the imagery we've set forth about the shack and the tree and everything. I think we need an abstract rendition of this. We need a grand watercolor hanging on the cable.
Well,
here.
Now, if you go to, I think that the link still works. It was grahamianreport.com/Gray Street. You know, Caleb had been for a long time doing a comic which features an artistic rendering of the entrance to the bunker. And if you really know where to look, by the way, there is also, first of all, there's the elevator entrance, which is our primary entrance, but there's, of course, a back door as well. And if people know where to look online, there is actually a picture of me standing outside the cave entrance to the back door of the bunker. And, of course, I'm standing there, I mean, outside of the cave with my tea mug and my brown corduroy jacket. So, yeah, if you know where to look, you've probably seen photos online of the entrance to the bunker. It's quite enigmatic. Had you never seen this, by the way, Matt?
No, I hadn't. I just, and for everybody out there, it is GRAYSTREET. So
all one word, right?
Yeah.
So, GrahamianReport.com/Gray Street. Yeah. So you didn't know about our official comic book.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's a like a corduroy jacket requirement to enter the bunker.
Not necessarily, but it is advised. More for protection. A mild bit of protection from falling debris from the cave ceiling. It's always advisable.
I thought it may worn off the Hadals a little bit or something.
Well, we haven't had too much trouble from the Hadals recently. I mean, it really reached an apex years ago when Matt and Chris Hayes and I were down here, and there was a civil war going on between two factions of the Hadal resistance. And, yeah, we unfortunately got caught in the middle of that. Our elevator went down. We were stranded below ground, and we were able to send out a distress signal and get out by next week, roughly just in time for broadcast. So,
yeah.
Graylian Report has its own mythos. That's what's so great about it. But all kidding aside, I do love... well, I shouldn't say kidding aside because, I mean, guys, I'm not kidding.
We never kid.
We never kid, ever. Never, ever.
It's real.
It is real, yeah. I'm more real than most could even imagine. But, I mean, I do love caves. And I do, when I have time, spend as much time in caves as I can. Back in 2012, in fact, Greg Newkirk and his wife Dana and their traveling companions came all the way down here to have me take them into the heart of the Linville Gorge and take them into a cave at the base of a cliff. So I know about the existence of many caves. Does that make me a cave man in some capacity?
Perhaps so. Okay. Perhaps that's that double meaning of words we were discussing yesterday.
Cave. Mm-hmm. You know, McNonymous and I wrote a book about that years ago. It was called A Field Guide to Cave People, Volume 1, Which Caves Are People?
I did it ever hit the bestseller list?
No, it didn't.
But I'm surprised.
It was a joke. It was completely a joke. But I will, full disclosure, we put a picture of it looked like a Sasquatch running with a spear in its hand. We put that on the cover of this tome of knowledge, and we put it up on Facebook. And it was obviously just a joke. Volume 1, Which Caves Are People? Get it? Get it? And there was a Bigfoot research group that grabbed it, and they reposted it on their page, and there was this huge thread on this post talking about people who said, oh, the cave people are real, and they thought it was a real book. Oh, man. Yeah, it was a classic prank. Classic prank indeed. So, anyway, I wasn't intentionally trying to prank anybody either. It was a joke. We did all kinds of field guides. That was our thing. Our first field guide was A Field Guide to Bears, Volume 1. What is a bear? We did A Field Guide to Dating, Volume 1. What is a date? You know, it hit its climax when we did A Field Guide to Cave People, Volume 1, Which Caves Are People.
I think it's great. I think we need to bring it back. We should go find that somewhere in the archives, I'm sure.
I don't know. Some of those fashion trends, I think, are much better when they don't come back. Let's forge ahead. Let's do something all new.
Okay.
Here's something all new, by the way. And there are, from time to time, very strange things that turn up in sewers. Okay. Use your imagination. Fortunately, in fact, actually, I'll stop you right there. You don't even have to. I'm going to tell you all about this. You know, for instance, tourists who visit the town of Klosterneuburg, I believe, in eastern Australia is where this happened. Yes, those who visit Klosterneuburg often head for the 12th century monastery, which exists there. There's also a nearby memorial to the author Franz Kafka. Yeah, that's what people typically go to this town for, okay, when they make their pilgrimages. But virologists and evolutionary biologists in the future may one day pay homage to the town's sewage treatment plant, which is apparently, according to Live Science, yielded a genome that appears to be from the most cell-like of viruses ever found. Now, this is strange because this has actually raised questions and a bit of a debate in the scientific community about the potential for a fourth domain of life. Live Science reports that new giant viruses found at an Austrian wastewater treatment plant probably evolved from a smaller virus that picked up bits of genome from its hosts and incorporated that almost in a Frankenstein-like way and amassed this within its own genetic code. Now, the virus is four species in a new group that have been dubbed as the town after which they're named, Klosterneuviruses. They are a type of mimivirus. These giant viruses in the mimivirus group were discovered just in 2003. I mean, that's like for the broader category. And giant viruses, as they are known, they live up to their name. They can reach sizes of up to 500 nanometers in diameter compared to a few dozen nanometers for typical viruses. Giant viruses also have more complicated genetic machinery than their tinier cousins, which makes them extremely different from other viruses and, in fact, much more like cells. But it, again, raises that debate. if we have giant viruses that are much more like cellular organisms, but they aren't, but they're bigger than any other virus, I mean, by, you know, I mean, several orders of magnitude, I mean, what exactly are we dealing with here? Now, Science Mag reported on this also, noting that these oddities challenge the controversial hypothesis that so-called giant viruses are descendants of a vanished group of cellular organisms in themselves, which might be recognized as a fourth domain of life in biology. But a study that was recently authored about this argues instead that these outsized viruses may have more pedestrian origins, despite the raging debate. Now, one of the new Clostridium viruses, for example, is so big that it carries transfer ribonucleic acids, or otherwise known as tRNA for those who are in the know. You get my lingo, right?
I'm right there with you, pal.
I know you are, buddy. Yeah. I know you are. But anyway, these transfer ribonucleic acids can translate the genetic code for 19 out of the 20 protein-building amino acids found in nature. Okay? Now, that's pretty impressive, even for a giant virus, according to scientists led by Tanjo Woke of the Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute, who reported on April 6th this remarkable finding, however you look at it, in the journal Science. The discovery of the new viruses was, of course, accidental. I mean, it's not really the kind of thing you go looking for in a sewage treatment plant. But the research team, of course, says that combing through genetic sequences from the wastewater treatment plant has allowed them to try not only to understand this particular discovery, but bacteria that convert ammonia to nitrate during the treatment process. So they say finding a giant virus genome took the project in a completely new and unexpected yet very exciting direction, and these enormous genomes of the new viruses allow the researchers to compare them to other giant viruses and the lineages of the so-called mimivirus group. Now, their analysis apparently showed that the new giant viruses were a patchwork of genetic information. And again, they think that most of this was picked up from host cells over time. So think about this. I mean, there was a recent study that was talking about how squids and octopi can modify their own DNA in certain ways. But we're talking about a creature that picks up little bits of genetic information over time and slowly over time is modifying itself, growing, and, well, essentially becoming an all-natural, tiny and yet still giant by comparison, a minuscule Frankenstein in nature. The viruses probably infect single-celled microorganisms called protists that live in the wastewater treatment plant there. Giant viruses have also been found in marine environments, in pond sludge, and even in deep permafrost. I think that down off the east coast of North Carolina, well, right around the east coast in the New River, I think that there was a similar kind of a virus that was discovered years ago because there was so much waste from pig farms that was running off into the river. And the additional protein content from that waste was allowing, I think in those cases, it was actually a mutation. But then again, we've got cell microbiologists out there in the listening audience with whom I correspond quite often. So maybe you guys can give us a breakdown of what the difference is. I mean, when we've got something that's literally rewriting its DNA over time and becoming something unlike anything we've seen elsewhere versus a simple mutation of a known organism. Yeah. Either way, these guys found in Austria are being referred to as the Goliaths of the giant virus world. Quite fascinating stuff. I'll tell you what's also fascinating. Did you know, Matt, that there is information now that we know about the early days of NASA?
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, well, but there's more.
Okay. Oh, okay. Sorry.
We also are learning that when NASA was sending people into space initially, it wasn't just to get into space. Now, Neil Tyson has talked about this a lot. I'm sorry, Neil deGrasse Tyson. If I don't say his famous middle name, people won't know who I'm talking about. Yes, but Neil deGrasse Tyson, science advisor to the Grayling Report, I'm kidding. Neil has often talked about this, the fact that if there hadn't been a Cold War, we might not have gone to the moon. And the reason that we were going into space was to show our technological power and proficiency at that time. What we're also learning, however, is that we were utilizing sending astronauts into space and other operations overseen by NASA over the decades for espionage. And that was kind of what was going on when we sent, for instance, Gordon Cooper into space. And there was an ABC News report recently talking about Daryl Miklos. He's hunting for sunken treasure now in the Caribbean. And to do this, he is using a secret map that he said was created from one of NASA's first astronauts, the aforementioned Gordon Cooper. And he apparently plans to document the experience of trying to find this treasure as part of a new Discovery Channel series. And in this ABC News report, he says, yes, he obtained this treasure map directly from Colonel Gordon Cooper. They were friends. They'd been friends for a long time. And they said that the public purpose of Cooper's first mission was to study the effects of prolonged weightlessness on the human body. But again, as we now know, there was apparently another secret task that he was being asked to carry out, one that required him to take thousands of photographs of the Earth's surface. And they say in one message to ground control from space, Cooper is recorded saying, "Man, all I do is take pictures, pictures, pictures. I'm up to 5,245 right now." And here's what he was looking for. Specifically, they were trying to find evidence of possible Soviet nuclear missile sites off the coast of the U.S. Yeah. In other words, according to Mr. Miklos, his friend Gordon Cooper was essentially conducting a clandestine spy mission while in orbit. We have audio.
It's a quest that began half a century ago with one of NASA's original astronauts. Colonel Gordon Cooper, Gordo for short. Turns out the real purpose of Cooper's first mission, launched 7 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, was top secret.
And all I do is take pictures, pictures, pictures.
He was in some sort of NASA spy mission, basically?
Exactly. I think he had a special DOD mission, Department of Defense, to try and identify nuclear threats.
But while he was up there, he spotted some other objects of interest.
Exactly. He made the treasure map from space.
Cooper mapped out dark anomalies in the waters known as the Bermuda Triangle.
They were in shallow waters and shallow reefs, so he deduced that, I know what that is. Those are shipwrecks.
Gordon Cooper died before he could find any of these shipwrecks. But he did share his research with one man, Daryl Miklos. Now Miklos is following Cooper's treasure map from space.
These are the actual documents right here.
Discovery cameras documenting the incredible journey.
This one wreck site right here, which would be well over $500 million.
Time to cue the intense music there, by the way. Anyway, I think you get the idea. But I thought it was really interesting, not only that there was this clandestine spy mission going on and that Cooper was looking for these kind of locations, keeps noticing dark patches out there and wonders if these might not be shipwrecks, but also, of course, that these were many of them found in the Bermuda Triangle. So there's the espionage aspect. There's the spy mission that he was undertaking. There is, of course, the search for missing treasure and, yes, within the Bermuda Triangle. I mean, this is like so Graylian.
You have to admit it's hilarious, though, to think about what a big achievement this is, what a big step forward in understanding our existence, not only in our galaxy, but just in general. Like, we're here, and we're exploring new frontiers, and our first thought is like, let's capitalize and let's spy on everybody else, you know?
Well, again, you know, what I think we are learning.
And that's not just U.S., I'm saying that. Every country, I'm sure. And it just says it speaks worlds to who we are as a species.
It does. It really does. And that's one of the things that, again, we have to remember here. You know, we're coming up on a break, but I'll just say this much, that as we look at what role we and our again, whether it be aviation or our space program, you know, divisions of government, what roles our agencies have stated, the public statement about what their role was. And then there's the actuality, which often is multifaceted. As we learn more about our history and the operations of government, the kinds of information that government agencies and officials are interested in, and what kind of information is often withheld from the public, again, we can look at the history of the space program, and we begin to see with time that, well, maybe the space program wasn't just a space program. Again, I mentioned that Neil deGrasse Tyson has said this plenty of times, but with more information forthcoming over the years and over time, we're learning more and more about the actual true reasons for sending people into space. And I think more and more why we see less and less of it as time goes on. I don't know. You know, Trump keeps saying we're going to be sending people back into space. Then again, we're also coming very dangerously close, I think, to essentially being on par with the political tensions internationally that we saw during the Cold War. So one way or another, we may be seeing more people go into space. But this is what I always talk about. When we talk about like secret space programs and stuff, I mean, the Russians had their manned orbital laboratory, and that wasn't to go up there and study stuff in space. That was to be able to keep an eye on what the U.S. was doing. It was essentially a laboratory in orbit, and it was fixed with cameras and telescopes, and yeah, they were intending to spy. And that's fascinating stuff. If you ever have an exhibit and you can really study the history of the cosmonauts or the American space program, I mean, it's really fascinating, all the little nuances. It makes you wonder, I mean, what does the government really know? I mean, we often ask on this program, and many people in this community ask, what does the government really know about UFOs? As we see more technology over the years, we think constantly about, well, self-driving cars may be right around the corner, but what will artificial intelligence be like? in the coming years. And then, as I often try to think, as technological as we're becoming as a society, what can we still learn about ourselves? You know, how can we look within and understand maybe the spiritual dimensions of humankind? And whether it's, you know, strange events of the past or secret locations in enemy territory that we're talking about, I think the fundamental underlying theme, I mean, is there really truly anything right now in this world that should not be explored? I think we have more questions by far than we do answers. And of course, for people who have questions, we have to recommend our friends at Gaia. You can head over to gaia.com/Graylian and see some of the programs that we recommend to our listeners, people who have questions like you, like me, like Matt. Matt even asks questions from time to time. Matt, the question asker. Yeah. Now, of course, if you become a member at Gaia, you can get full access to all the documentaries, the films, the TV series. They have short features there, too, that discuss all these kinds of subjects and more, ranging from artificial intelligence to, again, the idea of secret space programs and what the government may know that we don't. I think often it's taken for granted how much information is really kept off the books and withheld from the public. Gaia does attempt to provide a community for seekers where people can feel empowered who are on a path to finding a conscious way of life. And together we can awaken the evolution of consciousness, perhaps by helping each other out. And of course, you can help us by heading over to gaia.com/Graylian today. Check out what they have to offer. Proud sponsors of the Graylian Report. We appreciate what they do in keeping us on the airways. With that, when we come back, I want to get into a couple more news items and then look at the first batch of instances we're going to discuss tonight. People who go off the grid and sometimes come back. And looking in advance of that discussion, I'll leave you with this question heading out to the break. What would cause a person to disappear for decades and have no contact with human beings? A member of Hermits United, perhaps? More on that in a moment. It is the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Faded Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with Matt Oakley and Hobbo back in Master Control. Always glad to be your light here in the darkness of the Hollow Earth, where we have green screens and cherry apple trees, in addition to the cave algae that glows eerily on the walls. Incandescence. My mind is incandescent. Hope you guys are all feeling bright and beautiful out there, Graylians. Shout out to everybody who's hanging with us. Let's see here. Adam K. Olson, one of my official Illuminist appointees in the world's most secret society, in the chat room there. Always sending along nice news tips. And so you guys can do the same if you want to. Join our ranks. Info@GraylianReport.com. Info@MicahHanks.com. If you want to send along news tips for items we will feature in our daily news roundups at GraylianReport.com or feature on this show. Paul McBay, our friend down in Charleston, also just tweeted at us there.
Good to hear from Paul, always.
Indeed, yeah. And good to hear, of course, from all of you guys in the chat room or those of you operating on Twitter. What's this? We got another tweet from somebody. It's Ryan Wetzel, and he says, Micah, just me and the TARDIS, where were you? And he sends a picture of him outside my TARDIS. First, Ryan, what are you doing with my TARDIS? I was probably inside making brunch. Yeah. Okay. That or I was out in the jungle, you know, hanging with my monkey kindred. Although, I'll tell you, it's no joke when it comes to getting lost in the jungle. The story recently aired about Indian police who are reviewing reports of missing children to try and identify a girl who was found. She'd been living in a forest and apparently was actually accompanied by a group of monkeys. See, we talked recently on this show about a man who was lost for about a week in the Amazon, and he reported that while he was lost, that monkeys were assisting him, that they were leading him to food and sometimes leaving him items.
Yeah.
He said he was able to survive for a whole week, right? Well, this young girl, believed to be between 10 and 12, They say she was unable to speak. She was wearing no clothes. She was emaciated when she was discovered in January and then was taken to a hospital. And apparently now resides, as this report seems to indicate, in a town in Uttar Pradesh state in northern India. Now, they say that when she was found, that she behaved like an animal, running on her arms and legs and eating food off the floor with her mouth. I mean, this is, you hear classical cases of things like this from time to time. I mean, the real life Mowgli, you remember, of course, from the Jungle Book?
Yeah.
Rudyard Kipling. As though this is a real life counterpart to that. Now, they say that after treatment, the young child began walking normally and eating with her hands, although they still say she's unable to speak, although she does seem to understand whatever you tell her and even smile. So she can understand you, but she doesn't speak herself. Now, some woodcutters apparently spotted the girl roaming with monkeys. Police officer Dinesh Tripathi had told Associated Press last week. They said that the girl was naked and was very comfortable in the company of the monkeys, and when they tried to rescue the girl, they were chased away by the monkeys who tried to protect the child. She was rescued later by police officers, and when we called the girl, they said the monkeys attacked this primary officer, but he was able to rescue the girl nonetheless. He sped away with her in his police car while the monkeys gave chase. Poor monkeys, they felt like one of their own was probably taken. But we do see things like this happen, and I do strongly suspect that, especially when we have an infant, a lot of animals will, you know, that maternal instinct will kind of kick in. And then if bonding ensues thereafter, it doesn't matter how different somebody might look or something may look, you do see these kind of things. One of the most fascinating pieces of footage I'll probably ever have recalled seeing was a jaguar who killed a baboon. And after killing it, found that it had been a mother with its infant. And the jaguar, instead of consuming the infant, leaves the mother, takes the little baby baboon up into a tree and tries to care for it. Now, the baboon eventually, of course, died, the little infant. But the instinct, that maternal instinct, even with a predator like that, is fascinating. But speaking of these vanishing acts, Matt, this is probably one of the strangest ones. And you had found this story about this fellow from Brazil who has mysteriously vanished. And what he left behind, all he left behind apparently, was a locked room covered in coded writings and strange pictures of extraterrestrials. There was video linked with this, and I have to say, what was inside that room was extremely strange, don't you think?
I think so. It's honestly a little bit creepy, the video that they have up in this story. They say it's a bedroom, but it looks nothing like a bedroom. Everything looks white. It looks like he's posted pages of Bible verses and all kinds of stuff. Apparently, Da Vinci stuff was all over the walls, like wallpapered on there. It looked almost like a sterile environment. And then there was a statue of some sort. And then the thing I found interesting were there were like 14 spiral-bound notebooks, like laminated. And they just had Roman numerals on each one, on the cover. Nobody, like, they opened one, but you couldn't really see what was in there or anything. And it's apparently, they're saying it's some sort of manifestos, like 14 manifestos to change the world, quote unquote.
See, stuff like this is so strange. What do you make? I mean, sometimes I just wonder if people aren't just a basket full of crazy. Then again, though, if you're somebody like me and you really enjoy a good mystery, I mean, it's hard not to want to kind of look at something and say, I mean, is there some message that's been left behind by this individual? I mean, we're wondering right now really where he was. It was reported by the Metro in the UK, of course, that he has vanished. And while some are saying, well, the aliens came and picked him up, again, there was a video, as we noted, that features these cryptic writings that was uploaded, and you can find that online. There were a lot of occult things that were associated with it too, Matt. Pentagrams, stuff like that, in addition to the Roman numerals and the texts. And yeah. Now, relatives said that he couldn't reveal, according to what he told them, what he was working on, but he claimed that he was writing a series of books that would change humanity in a good way. Apparently, family members have tried to call him on his cell phone. They say it's off. They say he's never left like this before. He didn't apparently take anything, and the last time that he was seen, he was leaving home. This is just the kind of stuff, though, that, I mean, really gets people wondering, especially after what happened to Max Spears late last year. Now we've got this bizarro case of this guy vanishing. I mean, let's hope he turns up. Maybe he can tell us what happened. Maybe he just went on a spiritual retreat. Maybe they'll find him in the jungle with monkeys.
I don't know. There's this weird photo. It looks like a painting, though, that's on his wall of him in, like, this shroud. It's like a silvery or white shroud with an alien standing right behind him with a, a hand on his shoulder, and then like a Saturn in the distance behind them and stuff. It's
what if it's a real picture?
That's, hey, it looks like a painting, but you know, there's Snapchat and Facebook filters, right, to do that kind of stuff. So
what if this guy just had like a screw loose and decided just to take off? And what if he turns up years later? Matt, have you heard the story of the North Pond Hermit?
I have. It's a strange story.
There's a new book coming out about this, but National Geographic reported on it recently. Those who don't know about the North Pond Hermit, this is really bizarre. In 1986, Christopher Knight was 20 years old, and he apparently left his home in Massachusetts. He drove to Maine. He disappeared into the woods. He lived in a tent in the forest. He lived on food that he stole from nearby cabins. It is said that Knight didn't have a conversation with another human being for nearly 3 decades. Not until, and I remember when this happened, I remember the news of his arrest. He was arrested for breaking into an empty summer camp for the disabled. But the question again is, what makes a person abandon the world and become a hermit? Was Chris Knight, National Geographic asks, merely an antisocial loner? A high-functioning sociopath, perhaps? Or does he have something important to teach us? These are some of the questions that Michael Finkel, in this book called The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit, he asks these questions. What was this guy up to? What can we learn from studying somebody like Christopher Knight? Now, according to Finkel, Knight lived for 27 years completely alone in the woods of Maine and didn't even light a fire in the winter. Didn't have a single conversation with another person in that time. Didn't send an email or communicate with the outside world in any way. He was a complete loner living by himself, stealing for food, not lighting fires. Yeah.
That was one of the things that perplexed me, because as harsh as the winters, they were saying some of the winters got pretty harsh. So
in Maine, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how do you not light a fire or something like that? They said he took batteries for flashlights and stuff like that, but that was the only source of light. And, you know, I guess who knows how he kept warm in those conditions.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of pressing questions. So, you know, Finkel's looked into his family. He says he grew up in a private family. And by that, I mean, he meant these people kept it themselves. When he went missing, they were concerned, but they didn't report it. That's the kind of private we're talking about. He had 4 older brothers and a younger sister. By all accounts, the Knight children were extremely smart. They said that the type of family rare in this day of age, who were lower middle class and not with a lot of money, but in the evening read Shakespeare and poetry. They also knew how to fix automobiles and plumbing and studied thermodynamics as a family together, you know?
I think they may have read a bit too much Thoreau, though.
Yeah, that's possible. They knew that water molecules are what's called sticky during the day, and that they gather heat, and at night they release it. The family was able to grow food in the greenhouse all winter in Maine without paying a dime to the electric company. They said that Knight himself was extremely shy all his life. He found human interactions dauntingly complicated. I don't know. I mean, I might actually relate to him there, but I digress. At the age of 20, he drove his car into northern Maine, left the keys on the center console, and just walked into the woods. The family never called the police or filed a missing persons report at all. So this guy had been among America. Well, I don't know. He wouldn't have been among America's missing, despite missing for decades and having no contact with people. Yeah.
Now, the thing, and one of the reasons I found this story so compelling, dare I say, and I'm sure you'll know where I'm going to go with this, is when we have the missing link discussion from time to time. Mm-hmm. We have discussed, you know, kind of people who have gone off the grid, so to speak. This is a guy who successfully did it for decades. And he got caught because he was constantly breaking into houses. Think about people with more survival skills. They, you know, you might not ever see these people except in some rare chance encounter.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I heard this crazy story from up there in Kentucky a few years ago about a hiker who was out near Cloud Splitter Rock, and he saw what he said was a 30-something-year-old, completely naked, covered in mud and moss, guy with long hair and a beard, who ran off like an ape into the forest. Food for thought. We'll be right back. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, via KGRARadio.com, our home here on the darkest corner of the web. Yeah, so much going on. I tell you, I almost had to sound the fake news siren earlier there, Matt.
Well, that wouldn't be the first siren this week that went off.
Oh, is that so?
That's right. Did you actually see this story out of Dallas? It was 156 individual tornado warning sirens went off at the same time, and they're all there to meant the to warn the collective 1.3 million people in Dallas of an impending disaster.
Well, now was there a disaster?
No, I assume someone hacked it.
Oh, yeah?
But the conspiracy theories have already started flowing in, of course. It wouldn't be a story without conspiracy theories.
Here's one for you. Must have been the aliens.
It must have. Could have been the government.
Could have been, yeah.
But apparently these sirens went on from 11:44 p.m. and didn't stop till 1:20 a.m. Just incessant for that long.
Really?
I can't imagine.
And they couldn't like shut these things down? There's not like a master switch or something?
Apparently not.
I mean, what if it was just like a glitch though?
That's what I've wondered, or somebody hacking it or something like that. But people have discussed all kinds of theories about the happening. Of course, the prominent one was they thought at the time it was the start of a Russian invasion.
Oh boy.
Or some others had thought that it was a disease epidemic that had start, you know, just an explosion of a disease. Many people likened it to the horror film from a couple years back, The Purge. Did you ever see that?
No, I just remember Kevin Smith in explaining why he wanted to make a film like Tusk. He said, there's The Purge, and that was a dumb idea for a movie, and I thought, that's dumb. I could do something equally dumb. And so he did Tusk.
I enjoyed Tusk, but
did you enjoy The Purge?
I liked the first Purge movie. The subsequent ones are terrible.
Now, hold on. Remind me, isn't that about like...
all crime is legal for 24 hours.
So that people basically, you know, dog eat dog and whoever's left standing.
And I thought the first movie conveyed the idea really well. Like I said, the sequels, not so much. But the whole central premise to the original was that we reached kind of a critical mass in our society. Poverty was getting out of hand, all kinds of this stuff.
And so everything just turns into escape from New York for like 24 hours.
Well, they said, you know, all crime is legal for 24
hours. Sorry.
I love it. It's on Netflix again.
I know.
I love it. I'll watch it.
Call me Snake.
but the whole idea was that they were able to eliminate poverty and all kinds of stuff started becoming better. And obviously the inference is that poor people can't afford to protect themselves, so they're the first to die off, and it's kind of a survival of the fittest picture, but it's about the moral implications of society doing something like that, even if on paper or on the television it looks like 364 days out of the year we're doing better than we have been for decades. So I thought that was a really interesting premise, and I thought they pulled it off, personally.
Yeah, absolutely. You can tell by my yawning how interested I am.
Yeah, right.
Just kidding. Sorry. Well, who knows what was going on down there in Dallas. You know, one more funny thing. I think we've got time for one more thing. I'll just fit in really quickly before we go to break. I've wondered for a long time if I'm a mutant. I sometimes pick up on strange impressions of things. I'm not sure if I'm just a mastermind like Sherlock Holmes or if I'm Charles Xavier and I can actually pick up on something else. I mean, I'm kidding. In fact, I go back and forth on the whole psychic thing. I definitely feel like there have been times where I've had, for lack of a better term, what you might call premonitions. I don't know if I can look at that as proof of psychic phenomena, per se. And I definitely think a lot of psychics, professional psychics, are cold readers and do stuff like that. And the more I've studied magic and illusionists and things over the years, the more I've really come to understand, I mean, how people can do that. And there are a lot of illusionists who would tell you, I mean, some of these really good cold readers and psychics probably have learned how to do this and taught themselves. It's an intuitive thing, but they don't even realize that they're doing it. Some, maybe not all, but some may believe they're psychic when in fact they aren't. But I've wondered if some of us might be mutants, kind of like in the X-Men films, kind of like Charles Xavier. And in fact, there was a new study that discussed how researchers looked at 70 people from 6 families and found that a mutation in a gene called CRY1 was common among those who have a condition known as delayed sleep phase disorder. Now, in people with this condition, the circadian clock actually runs behind, so they wake up later than normal, and they go to bed later than normal, too. So if you're a night owl, you might actually be an X-man. I think that's what essentially they're saying here. They say that this mutation was absent in the members of these same families who did not have DSPD. And in addition, the researchers showed in lab experiments that this gene may play a key role in driving the circadian clock. It's the first genetic mutation found to be associated with DSPD. Isn't that interesting? So if you're a night owl, yeah, you might be a mutant. Sort of. Well, you may have a mutation. Kind of interesting nonetheless. We'll be back right after this.
The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Bringing you your weekly dispatches from across space-time. That's right, I'm Micah Hanks, along with the Reverend Oakley and Hobbs. As we continue to try and find Hobbs, there's a word or two there in the chat room about some slightly choppy audio. Ah, who knows? Who knows?
Who knows?
It could even be the psychic circuits here in the TARDIS itself. Yeah. Hey, if you aren't already a part of Team Grailian, it's easy to do. Head over to grailianreport.com/X. And there you can sign up for Grailian X. Get additional programs. Here in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be putting out another edition of Grailian Enigmas. Of course, we really enjoy that. And I hope that you guys enjoy it as much as we do. Storytelling of the eerie variety at its very finest. And I've got a whole slew of emails I haven't gotten back to yet from people out there with podcasting questions. But I'll tell you, if you are someone who wants to throw your hat into the ring and become a podcaster, first thing I'll tell you to do, go to maverickpodcasting.org and check out my book on that. There's also some free articles there at the website that'll tell you a little bit more about the craft that Matt and I have undertaken. Yes, indeed. Yeah, that is available now and soon, of course, for members of the world's most secret society. We will have the secret handbook of the world's most secret society. It's a secret. That's why I can't talk about it. Because it's a secret.
Better shut up then.
Yeah. See, I did.
Yeah, I caught that.
You can't do that. You can't do that when you're live on the air.
No dead air, Micah.
No dead air because, again, what happens is that will trigger the dead air indicators on all the FM stations that are carrying us.
Yeah.
And that will cause program directors to lose their minds. They will be very unhappy, so... Yeah,
that's right. We're giving away the secrets of the trade right here, live on the air.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what Grailian does in general, is we focus on secrets and we try to unravel some of the mysteries of our day and age. I mean, that's what just kills me is in this era of fake news, after the whole Syrian thing the other night. I mean, I was tweeting about that. Did you see this, by the way? This is incredible. My initial reaction to that was really not very good, and I'm still not very comfortable with the idea of, oh, I don't know, launching missiles. And I was watching people in the media. Brian Williams was sitting there talking. I'm just going on and on.
Was he the one who said that...
It's beautiful. Look at this. Yes, beautiful missiles.
This is the moment Donald Trump became president of the United States.
No, that was Fareed Zakaria.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
No, but you need to hear Brian Williams sitting there. Yeah. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on Middle Theory. So if you would like to hear some coverage of news and current events, I know Grimestake there in the chat room is, of course, our minister of mugs for the world's most secret society. And if you don't know what I'm talking about when I say the world's most secret society, just head over to middletheory.com. It's a whole new podcast. Well, it's not new, but it's a whole different podcast from this one. It's just news and current events and conspiracies. So you might enjoy it. You don't have to like politics to enjoy the kind of stuff we talk about there. And if you're in the chat room, just ask Grime about that. He's definitely what we would call one of the fold, our official minister of mugs. And he's called that because, well, he, of course, creates coffee mugs. He gets awesome coffee mugs that soon to arrive, I think, on our doorstep at Graylian International, and we'll be sending out to a few people. But so really quickly, before we start getting into some listener emails, I wanted to kind of share some interesting comments as it relates to the self-driving car thing. That's something we've been monitoring. And again, I'm looking at this as like a stepping stone toward the eventuality of an automated society. And we're going to look back at this, I think, in the coming years and go, wow, you know, that was really when things started to change. And we're going to say, wow, it really changed. And, you know, Uber, for instance, Matt, has said that in the coming years, companies like theirs will have to rely on self-driving cars in order to even survive economically. They say there's no way that we're going to be able to compete without having self-driving cars. Now, Jamie Condliff, what if that's like a Welsh name? Jamie is the associate editor of news and commentary for MIT's Technology Review, and he recently wrote a very interesting post about this. And here's what he had to say. He said, electric cars will be good for the planet and autonomous vehicles will reduce the number of road accidents. That much we know. But what other impacts will the coming automobile revolution provide? He says, first, a bit of managing expectations. And let me just tell you really quickly, the title of this says it all. Self-driving and electric cars are going to have tons of weird effects on society. Well, strange effects is what he said, but he says, first, a bit of managing expectations. Without regulatory incentives, America's electric car adoption looks like it will be slow to grow, and the first wave of autonomous cars might prove to be rather underwhelming. And while automakers and technology firms are indeed racing to reboot our cars, making these technologies seemingly inevitable, they are likely to take a while to get here. Now, what's less certain is how they'll change the world. Coming back to my fundamental point. And Jamie writes, Benedict Evans, a partner at the Silicon Valley Venture Capital from Andreessen Horowitz, and no stranger to tech trends analysis, has published some thoughts on what he calls second and third order effects of the disruption that's going to play out on our highways. And his insights describe a future made fundamentally different by these technologies. He says, first of all, consider electrification. We know that losing the internal combustion engine will be good for the planet, but as Evans points out, a lot will change when the supporting infrastructure for gas guzzlers disappears. Many repair shops will be out of a job because most car maintenance is going to be focused around the motor. And gas stations aren't going to have a purpose. So what happens to the convenience stores that they contain and half of America's tobacco sales and gas stations? What's going to happen to that? As for self-driving cars themselves, every company involved in the nascent industry is keen to point out that autonomous vehicles will crash less frequently than those driven by humans. But the benefits of a car that can drive itself aren't limited to moving folks from point A to point B. It can also go park itself somewhere usually considered too inconvenient for human passengers, ready to be beckoned when needed. Think about that. Cars on call. Anybody own that domain, Matt? Get on that right now. Carsoncall.com.
I'll write it down here.
Like, no, buy it right now.
Okay.
I'm serious. Stop eating my sesame cake, by the way. Please. Thank you. But that means that huge swaths of land in the hearts of cities currently used as parking lots can be repurposed too, potentially upending the real estate market. And these are just a couple of the examples Evans provides, and there are far more than that to consider. He also traces out large-scale ramifications of the electricity industry as home solar storage systems for car charging help solve the problems of peak demand. And I think that one thing we have to think about in the proper context with all this, Matt, is as we are seeing the automation of society and machines that are moving autonomously and independently of us, all around us. As we're seeing that, and we're seeing perhaps more efficient use of electricity, but also a certain degree of restructuring of industry, we pair those things with such issues as overpopulation and general scarcity that economics deals with, food, housing, all these kind of things. I mean, will we move toward a utopian society, or will we instead see a restructuring of society with more people, but with more, perhaps, I don't know, vertically dense population centers? Again, I can't think about all these issues that Jamie brings up in this technology review blog and not think about, again, the old concept, build up, not out.
Yeah.
More parking garages building up. I mean, will we have skyscrapers that are essentially car garages for self-driving cars that will let you out and then they will go and they can be, you know, summoned by a radio pulse or a psychic pulse or whatever Now, you can get the car to come back and get you, but you don't need to know where the car went and parked, and you don't have to worry about finding parking. The car picks you up, it drops you off, and then it goes someplace until you need it again. I mean, quite interesting.
It is interesting, and as I was reading this piece, there's so much that I think, you use the word automation. I mean, not just the car market, but automation in general is something we've addressed before, I believe, on the show, that so many jobs... Politically, we have candidates sitting out there saying, you know, well, we can't bring back the coal industry jobs because those jobs are now done by machines.
Uh-huh.
And so there seems to be this growing attitude, I think, in the world that says you're not any longer going to be the blue-collar worker. Now you're just going to be a programmer. But if you think about that, the scarcity of jobs, and that's where I start to get a little... freaked out, I suppose, is going to be enormous. When you think about a drone or something to that effect, delivery drones like Amazon's planning on using, things like that, when you think about a drone, a person can program that, yes, but there's not going to be one person programming one drone. One person could probably program, say, 10 drones. So you have a net loss of 9 jobs.
Yeah, good
there.
Point. In other words, yeah, just because there's going to be more automation in society, more drones flying around, that doesn't necessarily mean that there will there won't necessarily be as many jobs to account for the rise in artificial deliveries or autonomous deliveries, how you want to phrase that.
And then, in this article as well, you have the loss of perhaps gas station jobs, you have the loss of parking attendant jobs, things like this. I mean, maybe not all at once or anything like that.
Yeah, but I mean, there seems to be a fundamental restructuring of society that's going to be coming out of this, right?
And you have to wonder if we're, in a way, making ourselves obsolete in some fashion or another.
Yes, but I would term it differently. I would say it like this. I would say that we have evolved to this degree of technological proficiency, but now we are creating technology that, if you want to use the term evolution, it is evolving and is being steered by our hand in a way that is exponentially increasing and improving, and far more quickly than we can evolve and keep up with it. I mean, at some point, again, that singularity may not just be artificial intelligence. It may be the creation of enough technology and to a level of sophistication that it actually gets out of hand for us. You remember we had, what was it? I'm terrible with names, as you know, but his book was Overcomplicated. And we had him on the show to talk about this very thing. He was talking about the fact that, like, you have flight tracking systems and all kinds of technology these days, information systems that no single person knows how every component inherent to that machine works. I mean, like the MacBook Pro sitting in front of me here on the console. One individual couldn't take this thing and build every component that goes into making this computer. It's, as with all technology these days, essentially a cumulative effort.
Samuel Arbismann.
Arbismann. Great guy. We had him on the show. I'm sure when his next book comes out, we'll have him back, because, you know, these leading technologists, those are the kind of people I want to follow, Matt, because, again, as we're heading into shaky and perhaps unsteady territory in the future, it'll be interesting to see how that affects humans. It really will, which is so strange and paradoxical, because in the next segment, we're going to be looking at something entirely different. We're going to be going back in time and looking at lost civilizations, one of my favorite subjects. But first, I do want to get to some listener emails. Celso writes, I work in Kansas City, and I stepped out around midday today to get a coffee for a pick-me-up and was able to see a B-2 bomber flying around the area. Now, at one point, it appeared to have stopped in the air for a moment and then shoot off quickly toward the horizon. In your efforts to find a prosaic explanation regarding black triangles, seeing the B-2 appear to stop in the air and then take off quickly immediately reminded me about the various reports of the black triangle sightings. Now, perhaps what is being seen by people who report about black triangles are really updated versions of the B-2. I could see the bomber clearly because it was a beautiful day and the plane was on a blue sky background. It was incredible to see the bomber as clearly as I did, and even despite all this, I was unable to get any pictures. But imagining the idea of a newer, more capable version of a B-2 with the ability to hover does not seem impossible in my mind, and is a very plausible explanation for some of the black triangle sightings. Something to consider during the next report, as we have done. And thank you, Celso. I'll say this, though, that again, in terms of shape and design and also function, I certainly think that there probably are aircraft, and we've heard since the 1990s about this alleged Project Aurora, a supposed aircraft that would have gone into service following the decommissioning of the SR-71 Blackbird. And there is some evidence, I actually think, that suggests that there have been top-secret spy aircraft, and there were actually a couple that were photographed I think, back in 2015 over Kansas and Texas. And this seemed to be some sort of a flying wing type triangular aircraft. But, I mean, these things are distinctly like planes. Whereas in some of these triangle reports, we're talking about large, extremely large, some say as large as a football field, which is extremely telling to me. But again, there would be something that big screams blimp to me. I think that there are some extremely advanced as far as blimp type aircraft go, but I think that there are definitely some platform stealth blimp technologies that have been used over the years. But I also think that there are some spy planes, and as you describe, something that resembles a B-2 but capable of flight characteristics that are not commonly associated with the B-2. Indeed, I think that there are probably a couple of spy planes that are in operation that we aren't fully aware of, and that's at very least very interesting to me. I had a conversation with Robert Schaefer at the UFO Congress a while back. And, he had said to me in response to me saying, I mean, I think that a lot of UFO reports are aircraft of our very own, which may not be recognized at this time, but at some point eventually they will be. And he says, you believe that? And I said, well, sure. I said, I mean, that has to be more plausible than the idea that these things are all alien spacecraft, buzzing around. And he said, yeah, but if the government had information about these things, and these things had been seen decades ago, that information would have been released to the public. We'd know about them now. Matt, what do you think about that? That information that has, again, been kept from the public for maybe the last 2-3 decades, that we would have that information now, and if these things were ours, we'd know about it.
I really don't think that's a solid case.
The U-2 and the, that entire situation, heck, I mean, the actual official acknowledgement of Area 51 didn't come as a result of somewhat unrelated CIA documents that were only released, I think, 4 years ago, if that, maybe less than that. And I said that at that time. I said, again, it's not necessarily safe to assume that, well, if these aircraft, however exotic they may appear, if they're ours, we would have known that by now. And that's what I said to Bob at that time. I said, so are you telling me you think there's a better explanation for some of these things? And he said, yeah, I think in some of those cases, these people are just lying. So I said, well, let's do a blog together and call it The Lying Saucer. And we both laughed. And he said, we'd get sued. But I think it's important we don't assert that people are just liars. I think that Bob caught some heat for that, by the way. And I didn't mean for that to happen that way, because he went on the Paracast and they said, well, Micah said that you said UFO people are liars. I don't think he was saying that all UFO witnesses are liars by any means. But again, I think, though, if we're so skeptical that we can come up with no better explanation, how else are people going to interpret what you mean? But in his defense, I'll say, having been the one standing there talking to him, no, I don't think Bob Schaefer was saying all UFO witnesses are liars. But he and I differed on the point, despite our common ground, that, again, there might be government aircraft that account for these things. And see, what's interesting is that John Alexander, I think, would agree with him that it seems unlikely. And John, coming from a background in government and having said, I've spent time in government, I looked for this kind of stuff, looked for these kind of aircraft, found no evidence of them. I don't think these things are ours, but I also wonder sometimes, with need to know and all that, how much we really know about what we think is ours or not. Eric writes, hey, Micah, I'd just like to say your most recent Grailian report with the Raging Cajun was an outstanding program, mixing my love of pro wrestling with the unexplained. Absolutely fantastic job, Micah. Keep up the great podcasts, my man. GWO, which he says stands for Grailian World Order. Yeah, that's great. Well, you haven't heard
into it.
Yeah, you haven't heard the last from Lash LaRue, though. He'll be back. Oh, he'll be back, indeed. Brett writes, howdy again, Micah. In the last Grailian report, you touched on the topic of peripheral vision and tapping into the into all the visual input that we're all typically receiving, but not cognitively processing. Well, that reminded me of a tactical usage you're probably aware of, averted vision. He said, I wrote a short summary for a Did You Know Facebook group, and here's how it went. What do astronomers and police have in common? They both need to see at night, so they use averted vision. I am familiar with this, by the way. In fact, I think this kind of thing goes all the way back to feudal Japan, and ninjas purportedly did this too. This technique, known since at least Aristotle, is looking just to the side of a dim object while maintaining a peripheral attention to it. And he says, rods in the eye are most sensitive to darkness and light, black and white. The center of the eye is only cones, our color and brightness detectors, and are used where we directly look, the point of our gaze. Using averted vision in dim or very dark situations, the intent is to bypass our cones and maximize the surrounding rods, sort of like dialing up the contrast on your TV. Look down or up or left or right, results may vary, but it has worked for me in the past. Now, looking directly at Jupiter, for instance, in my small telescope's field of view showed a small disk. Looking just to the side revealed two subtle stripes in the Jovian atmosphere that weren't visible while looking directly at them. But it could prove useful in many situations like dark alleys. So he says, I've subsequently learned hunters and military sometimes use this, but besides gaining any sort of tactical advantage, it's sort of a nice metaphor for the Fortean pursuits that we're all interested in. It's just amazing that you'll see, or what you'll see if you're actually looking. And again, I think that's an important thing. I think that we have to keep in mind that how much, as you go about your daily life, do you miss because you weren't looking for it? Matt, have you ever thought that you missed certain things?
Absolutely.
What
way too much.
Yeah, like the grasshopper at your feet?
How did you know there was a grasshopper at my foot?
How is it, my son, that you did not? Andy writes, hi, Micah. I hope you're well. You mentioned Dell printers on your legendary show, including how much you spent over the years on ink cartridges. Yes. Ugh, there I go getting depressed again. He said, I just had to inform you and your listeners of something that you may not be aware of. And it's called CISS, Continuous Ink Supply System. These are large refillable ink tanks connected by a permanent hose to your tiny printer cartridge. And apparently there's one called the Black Tower Ink Fill Resystem, or Ink Fill System. And he links to that. So he says, thanks for the outstanding podcast, which is an absolute joy to listen to. And with best regards, Andy. Thank you for that, Andy. I really appreciate it. And of course, I have to say, I bit the bullet, Matt.
You bit it.
Yeah, we have a new chair here in the bunker.
I saw that.
As you can see, this large seat over here to your left, Matthew. Yep. The color multifunction printer.
I like how you're turning your microphone. It looked like you were just going to point the microphone at it.
Yes, I was going to interview the new color multifunction printer. Come step up to the microphone. Ah, here he is. Here's Robin. But no, yeah, I bit the bullet because, yeah, I needed a new computer or a new printer. I need a new computer too. But anyway, I'm going to leave it at printers for the time being. Hey, thanks to all you guys who have written in with your stories this week. There are even more emails out there floating around someplace in that liminal space between my computer and your minds. I'll hope to get to some of those really soon. That, and of course, the constant stream of messages coming in from people over here on the portable multifunction device on my desktop. Let's go ahead and go to a break, Matt, because when we come back, I want to get into some of these mystery disappearances that have taken place a little further out there, along with an appetizer or two. That's right. You got to lead up to the main course. Some significant archaeological discoveries have been abounding, and we're going to get to two of those, and then I'm going to talk about one of the most enigmatic mysteries of the 20th century right here on the Graylian Report. Dark Heart of the Hollow Earth. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Welcome back, everybody. Always glad to be here with you, keeping you company. As any good space-time companion should be doing, right? Glad to be your companion, as always. So, there have been a lot of interesting discoveries right now occurring in the area of archaeology. You know that's one of my very favorite subjects. And this is of particular interest to me right now because an ancient village, one believed to be older than the pyramids, has been unearthed by a University of Victoria student. Yeah, that's right. And a British Columbian First Nation says that it backs up tribe stories that have been passed down for generations. This also fascinating to me. The idea of cultural remembrances and mythology and stories that carry over with archaeological significance later determined by science. That may be one of my very favorite things. Now, Alicia Gavreau, an anthropology PhD student at the University of Victoria, has been excavating a rocky spit on Tricket Island, about 500 kilometers northwest of Victoria. And scientists are saying that the artifacts exhumed on this little remote island are painting a picture of how our civilization began. See, Alicia, again, and a crew have been excavating there. And she says, I remember when we get the dates back and we just kind of were sitting there and we're looking at it and going, holy moly, this is old. What this is going to do is it's going to change our idea of the way in which North America was first peopled. You got to keep in mind, let's travel back in time, okay? Back in the old days, maybe the 1910, 20s, we didn't believe that there was such a thing as Ice Age man in America or in the Americas. We didn't believe that there had been people here that early. And then there was a little discovery in a little town called Folsom. There was a black cowboy by the name of George Majunkin, and he was riding along at Wild Horse Arroyo. And there in the wall, washed out area after this flood, there was a huge flood that occurred this year in particular. And as he's riding along on Crowfoot Ranch there near the Arroyo, he's looking for damage from this flood, and he sees these bleached, what look like great big bones sticking out of the side of the bank. And so he rides over on his horse, and he jumps down, and he brings out some tools from his tool pouch, and he starts removing some of these bones from the clay in the bank. And he couldn't identify them, and he went and tried for years to identify these bones. Well, long story short, it took years before they could get people out there. And eventually, Jesse Figgins, up there at the Denver National History Museum, sent a group down to excavate properly. And not only did they find, in this layer of strata, about 10 or 11 feet down, all these animal bones, but then they started finding these little projectile points in situ alongside the bones. And we began to realize that these points, they had a strange little area, okay, where a part of the actual stone had been removed lengthwise along the actual point, and this is called a flute. And these so-called fluted lithics had not really been found before, although there had been a similar discovery a couple of years prior to what eventually became known from Folsom, New Mexico, as the Folsom culture. That's right. This is a fascinating discovery because it shows us that, yes, there had been Ice Age man in the Americas, but then a few years later, we find at Clovis, New Mexico, evidence of an even older culture. And this, of course, is recognized as the Clovis. Now, it gets a lot more convoluted than that because there are all different kinds of lithic types, stone artifacts that have been found, and maybe these are evidence of different kinds of groups and people, even maybe in numbers greater than just the Clovis and the Folsom. But what we are consistently finding is that although that at that time in the 1930s was a huge paradigm shift, Elias Herdlicka of the Smithsonian, he wouldn't even accept. He went to the grave not believing that there were people in the Americas coinciding with the Ice Age. And lo and behold, what do we find? We find evidence of it. And then later we start finding evidence of people who were here even earlier. As far south as Monteverde, Chile, near Puerto Montt, we have what's called the Monteverde site. And it is a pre-Clovis site. It goes back even earlier than the Clovis people should have existed. And here we have, again, the Victoria University student Alicia Gavreau assisting with this excavation of a 14,000-year-old village. And yeah, it's going to help rewrite history because it's further evidence that there were people here much earlier. And as we'll talk about in the future, I have some ideas about some things we're going to be discussing in the future on this program, but there's, I think, evidence of stuff much older even than that. But then I get ahead of myself, as time travelers tend to do. In other news, we also have a pair of archaeologists with the American Museum of Natural History, and they have unearthed a palatial compound in El Palenque's palace in the Oaxaca Valley in Mexico. And in this paper published recently in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Elsa Redman and Charles Spencer have described what they've uncovered and how they think that these findings fit with the emergence of organized states in Mesoamerica. You see, the Oaxaca Valley near the southern tip of Mexico has been offering up clues of past civilizations for several decades, and a team has been working at the El Palenque site in particular since 1993. But in this new effort, the researchers have been focusing on a dig on the north end of the plaza, the site of what the researchers believe was the home and business center for the ruler of an ancient empire. You see, this palace has been dated to approximately about 2100 to about 2300 years ago. And this was a time, of course, before the Aztecs. Most in this field believe that the civilization that existed in Oaxaca was among the earliest states to come into existence in Mesoamerica. Redman and Spencer suggest that their findings at the palace site back up that theory. They suggest that this palace is likely one of the oldest multifunctional palaces in the valley and offers more evidence of the advancement of an organized state in that area. The advancement. You see, there's a lot to the ancient world that we don't know. I've been down there, Matt, to a number of the ancient Mayan sites, and what's fascinating is specifically Lamanai up there, the city of the sunken crocodile. It featured a lot of ancient Olmec architecture. And, of course, we have a lot of questions about the Maya, but we have even more questions about who exactly the Olmec were. Who had been the progenitors of this extremely advanced technology and architecture for this period in the ancient past? And May this year, we're coming up on May, and it's going to mark the 92nd anniversary since, of course, Colonel Percy Fawcett lost contact with the world. You know, he was one of Britain's greatest explorers, and his life is essentially defined by a near-lifelong obsession that he had. That was, of course, the belief that somewhere out there, probably in the Brazilian jungles, there was an unknown ancient civilization. And Fawcett had a name for this place. He called it the Lost City of Z. Now, 1925, while in search of the fabled Lost City, Fawcett vanished along with his eldest son, Jack, taking any trace of Z and its whereabouts with them. So the Telegraph reports, because there's a film coming out about this very soon, and there's a great book that was written a number of years ago about this, too. And I'm, like all these kinds of things, I'm fascinated with the Lost City of Z. And the Telegraph reports that nearly a century later, what has been called the greatest exploration mystery of the 20th century continues to captivate and endure thanks to a new epic feature film. But following recent revelations about the scale of human impact on what was once thought to be a virgin forest, many have had a not-so-nice name for it, the Green Hill. But archaeologists are asking, could we discover the truth about this famous lost city of Z, and even what happened to Fawcett himself? I mean, you can list among the people who have disappeared under strange circumstances. Fawcett would probably, among famous disappearances in the last century, be high on that list. And it's important today to understand that, you know, again, he was more than a cartographer and an archaeologist. He was a celebrity. The 57-year-old British explorer's proposed trek through the terra incognita of Mato Grosso. Literally, that meant thick bushes. And if you ever go down there and you see that landscape, you'll know why. But it captured the imaginations of the media and the world all over. That's right. Now, Percy, of course, was born in 1867 in Devon. His father, born in India, was a British aristocrat and a fellow of the RGS and also a hopeless gambler and a drunk who squandered two family fortunes and besmirched the Fawcett name, much to Percy's embarrassment and disgust. Now, commissioned as an officer to the Royal Artillery in 1886, Fawcett served in the British colony of Ceylon, kind of like the tea. And there at Ceylon, he met his future wife, Nina Agnes Patterson. They wed in 1901. Well, it was a little more rocky than that, in truth. He had proposed to her, but then his mother didn't like the arrangements, and they said, "Percy, dear, she's not the woman you think she is." And so he broke off the engagement. Her heart was broken. She married somebody else. And the man she married died tragically just a couple of years later. And on his deathbed purportedly said to little Nina, "Go and marry Percy. He's the one for you." You know, you don't always end up in your first marriage with the person you were supposed to be with. And so Nina maybe didn't open her heart at that time, but Percy sure did. He goes back to Nina and he says, "Please take me back." And she said, "I didn't think that I would have any love for him, but when I saw him, I just started laughing." And sure enough, they were married in 1901. They had two boys, Jack, born in 1903, and also young Brian. And though Fawcett remained, as he described, a curious lone wolf exploring Ceylon and seeking buried treasure and investigating archaeological ruins, he was also very much the family man. And so in 1906, Fawcett did accept this unusual offer from the RGS to map some of the dangerous blank spaces in South America, and he loved it. He thought that the danger was part of what made it fun. And over the course of many years, broken only by a return to the army at the outbreak of the beginning of the First World War, he ventured out on a succession of missions to map the unknown jungle. Sometimes Fawcett would go down there alone, and he would go head-to-head against the jaguars, the pit vipers, which if they bit you, you start bleeding from your eyes and you take two steps and organ failure sets in. I'm telling you, that's not the kind of place where if you don't know what you're doing, that you want to go. And Fawcett was just fearless. He would go down there and he would become the jungle. And that's why when he went down there on what eventually became his ill-fated last attempt to find that lost city of Z, he only took two people with him, his son Jack and their friend, a small party of three. They vanished and were never found.
And so in the year 1925, just 182 years after Raposo's discovery, Colonel Fawcett leads his party into the green darkness of the Brazilian jungle. Days stretch into months, but still the narrow cleft of rock eludes them. And then, on the 29th of May, while his father is writing a letter home, Jack Fawcett enters the lean-to tent.
Oh, hello, my boy. Anything you want me to mention in my letter home?
No, I'll write later this week.
Something on your mind, Jack?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps you'd call it a premonition.
Premonition, eh? Uh-huh. Of what?
Well, I don't know, really. Just a... Oh, that's silly, I suppose.
No, not at all. I've seen some very strange predictions amongst my adventurers.
Well, it's just that... I think the canyon we're looking for is definitely within walking distance of this camp.
Hmm. What's the date today?
May the 29th. Why?
I just wanted to date this letter for home, that's all. Well, now, that's my duty done. I'll give it to the native bearer leaving for Sao Paulo. Then you can post it to England. You can take a walk before supper. Think of it? Which way would you like to go first?
Well, just before we stopped this afternoon, I thought I saw a dark shadow on one part of the cliff road.
A shadow, eh? Yeah, well, that could possibly be the entrance to a narrow ravine. All right, Jack. This time you lead the way.
I'll just get my helmet.
What happened on that quiet twilight walk can never be answered. For the letter he wrote was the last word ever received from Colonel Fawcett and his expedition. He and his son had walked into the green shadows of the jungle and simply vanished without trace.
That's more or less how it went down. And it's no surprise, the Telegraph reports, that when the communiques abruptly ceased from the bearded, blue-eyed, and Stetson-wearing Fawcett, who, by the way, of course, had been part of the inspiration for that famous, intrepid, swashbuckling adventurer, Indiana Jones. That's right. We talked pretty extensively about him on Graylian X over the weekend, Matt and I. Yeah. But in January 1927, again, close to 2 years since the receipt of the party's last message, the Royal Geographical Society, again, that we referred to here, the RGS, they accepted the men as lost. And they issued the following statement: "We hold ourselves in readiness to help any competent, well-accredited search party." Well, soon after the RGS's declaration that the party was lost, a torrent of pleading letters from intrepid volunteers followed. Yet, in the decades since, no one has found the remains of Fawcett, and it's estimated that up to 100 explorers have themselves, while going out looking for Fawcett, his remains, and any information that might lead to the discovery of the lost city that he believed to exist. That's right. Many of them have gone missing themselves. Yeah, did you know, in fact, by the way, that Ian Fleming, author of the James Bond books, Matt, his brother Peter also went on one of the failed expeditions. Obviously, he didn't go missing.
Mm.
Peter was an interesting guy, by the way.
He wrote a lot of books about adventuring and things like that, right?
He wrote a book called The Flying Visit prior to the end of the Second World War, in which Hitler flies a plane and comes to Britain and is captured, and they try to negotiate peace talks. Shortly thereafter, Rudolf Hess flies a Messerschmitt, crash lands in Scotland, and tries to initiate peace talks. Rudolf Hess, of course, was third in command under Hitler, but I mean, a lot of people had said maybe Ian Fleming, in addition to, or not Ian, it was his brother Peter Fleming, but maybe in addition to being an intrepid adventurer in his own right, he was also kind of psychic. Who knows? Now, you know, David Gran wrote a really good book about this called The Lost City of Z. I actually have a copy of this book. And he's a former staff writer of The New Yorker. And this is going to be a film that's coming out, I think, this month, in fact. There's a new film coming out all about what's based on Grant's novel, but I think the film takes place in the era of Percy and kind of focuses on Fawcett and his own disappearance. But Grant, he talks about some interesting stuff in this book. You know, he suggests that the trio reached what's called Dead Horse Camp. That was named for Fawcett's an earlier expedition, but it was where his horse actually died. And that they rested at the village of the Kalapalo tribe. Despite the tribe's warning that they would be killed by the fierce Indians who occupied the territory to the east, Fawcett and his two rookie companions, his son being one of them, by then apparently lame, apparently headed further into the forest. For the following five evenings, the tribe watched the smoke curl from the expedition's campfire before, on the sixth night, it disappeared. So Grant himself went down there, and he goes venturing into the mud and the gorges and the rapids, trying to find out if there was any oral history, if there was any forensic effort or record or anything that remained that would suggest anything about the fate of Percy Fawcett. And while he was there, he found no tangible evidence of Fawcett himself, but he did find something else. There's an area that may well have been lost and that was at one time the evidence or home of a lost civilization that we would call it today, Kuhi Kugu. It's what it's known as. If this location is what it appears to be, there may have at one time been a fairly advanced and fairly large civilization in the middle of the Green Hell, the last place on Earth one would ever expect it to actually be. Michael Heckenberger is a professor of anthropology at the University of Florida. He spent more than probably coming up on actually more than a decade researching what happened to Fawcett and what this lost city of Z that he believed to exist down there might have been. And in fact, Kuhi Kugu could be an archaeological site that is a leader. It could be it. That could be the place. Part of the reason that they've not been able to determine that prior to recent times is because you can be right up on an archaeological site of significance, and while you may be standing there, you may not see it, but with satellite imagery, we can determine from above more easily areas that where the soil has been affected by irrigation or by tilling or by just general human occupation. And so satellite systems and Google Earth and things like this are really helping archaeologists see potential archaeological sites that they might not on ground level be able to ascertain. And so we're learning an awful lot these days, and that's part of what's happening at sites like this. And now there are archaeological locations in Brazil and Peru and other places where people are going, wow, you know what? There may have been more to the legend that Percy Fawcett was after. And even though he didn't find it, presumably, and apparently died in the process, there may be evidence yet to emerge from the Amazon jungles that will indicate to us that there were people, lost civilizations, and perhaps cities that at least in terms of, well, relative to that part of the world and that time, yeah, that they were fairly advanced. I mean, it's fascinating. Talk about a mystery. We'll wrap things up here on the other side. It is the Graylian Report. Time traveling from ancient civilizations to an uncertain future. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report, wrapping things up this week. Hey, I hope you guys didn't miss your celebration on Friday. That's right. Of course, Friday was National Beer Day. So it's a fitting time for us, of course, to reflect on beer's powerful impact over the course of history. Since ancient times, Matthew, what we call here in the world's most secret society, of course, dad juice, Not only was it one of the first alcoholic beverages, making so, of course, because, you know, it's safer to consume than water, or it was in many instances back in the day, but, of course, its use as a ration among early civilizations in Egypt and Mesopotamia played a huge role in the creation of writing. I mean, there have been many archaeologists and historians who have said that really we cannot undermine the influence alcohol has had on the development of civilization as we know it. Silly though that may sound, I think that often a lot of the abstract thinking that has fomented creativity, that has led to the rudiments of progress and civilization, they come from our experiences with those mind-altering substances, whether created through a brewing process or discovered by other means. Now, at the PJ Media website, they have a great article that coincided with National Beer Day the other day. And they said, the history of beer as that of human civilization, in fact, begins in Sumer as the ancient Mesopotamia, roughly in modern Iraq. The world's first great literary work, The Epic of Gilgamesh, describes beer as one of the things that makes people human. In that story, Gilgamesh has adventures with Enkidu, who starts off as a wild man running naked in the wilderness, just like Map. But Enkidu is introduced to civilization by a woman. They placed food in front of him, they placed beer in front of him, and Enkidu knew nothing about eating bread for food and of drinking beer he had not been taught. The young woman spoke to Enkidu, saying, "Eat the food, Enkidu. It is the way one lives, and drink the beer. It is the custom of the land." And of course, well, the rest is history. This correlation of beer with humanity seems far-fetched today, but Tom Standage, author of A History of the World in Six Glasses, suggested that the need to provide a stable supply of bread and beer gave impetus to the first farmers and may have helped humans transition from hunter-gatherers to a sedentary farming lifestyle. So think about this for a second, ladies and gentlemen. As you're out there, many of you listening to this live broadcast or downloading the podcast, sometimes several days after the fact, because I know a lot of you guys are weekend listeners, you want to kick back by the fire, crack open a cold dad juice, and listen to the Graylian Report. As you're holding that frosty beverage in your hand, and you're imbibing and enjoying the rite and the ritual of the order, don't forget that the discovery, okay, of alcohol and its implementation by ancient cultures and the strange effects imbued upon humanity thereafter, and the creativity, perhaps, that stems from that may have influenced writing and civilization as we know it. The strangest things sometimes are what make us who we are. That's always comforting, isn't it? That's going to be the final word this week for the Graylian Report. Thank you, Matthew, as always, for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, Rayson Robert Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, and Tiffany Mack, I remain your doctor here in the dark heart of the Hollow Earth. It is the Graylian Report. We will catch you guys next week right here. And of course, as always, in the meantime, stay strange. Take care of yourself, guys. See you soon.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.